The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Broadcasting from our secret underground studio in Olympia, Washington, it is time for the Thunderbolts. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day you turned on your radio and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee! All right, so once again, I was forced to listen to all the experts and the talking heads from the media machine going on about how the United States, quote, miscalculated, unquote, the situation in Afghanistan, and how, quote, no one predicted, unquote, that the Taliban would so quickly steamroll through the country, taking over everything. Except for the fact that I frigging predicted exactly that, both over 5 months ago in the April 21st edition of the Thunderbolt newsletter, and in the subsequent June 4th radio show version of that prediction, in a piece called The Dirty Secret of Afghanistan. Yeah, they call it Summer Monday. Such luminaries as ex-CIA Director Leon Panetta, but Tuesday's just as bad, and ex-CIA Director David Petraeus, are amongst those, yeah, they call it Summer Monday, that are saying that no one predicted this outcome in Afghanistan. Now, to be clear here, I had no idea that I was expressing any amazing prescience or anything when I wrote that. I was merely reporting what my usual trusted journalistic sources were telling me was going to happen. And that only in passing, yeah, the eagle flies on Friday, whilst asking the overriding question of what the hell the entire Afghanistan intervention has been about, if the Taliban, yeah, the eagle flies on Friday, was simply going to end up back in charge after everything else had been said, done, and bombed. I assumed that the Taliban's eventual apotheosis was common knowledge amongst even casual observers of the situation, much less people who had actually been buried neck deep in formulating Afghan policies over the decades. But it would seem that such luminaries as Leon Panetta and David Petraeus have different sources of information than I do. When you are dealing with the CIA, though, nothing is ever as it would seem. And I think it is much more likely that rather than being naive or ill-informed, that Panetta and Petraeus are instead lying through their teeth in order to promote some dark, hidden political agenda. Leon Panetta also said that he had never trusted the Taliban because they are terrorists. Well, that may be, but I have never trusted Leon Panetta either, because he is a terrorist. So whatever. And as for Biden, due to his status as the first president in my adult life ever to exceed my admittedly very low expectations, all previous presidents have managed to slither under that bar, no matter how low I set it. And due to the fact that some legislation that is trying to get through Congress does some incredibly, truly good things. Yeah, you got to have mercy. Such as reducing child poverty by 50%, for instance. You better have mercy on me. Then it's kind of sad that old Joe has so profoundly bungled the pullout from Afghanistan. I'm all alone. Because this is going to be a big stain, if not a defining moment of his legacy. Yes, just as with Lyndon B. Johnson, whose many and truly transformative accomplishments as president will always be seriously overshadowed by his Vietnam legacy, any great things that Joe Biden might manage to pull out of any hats will now be darkened by this Afghanistan debacle. And it would seem that old Uncle Joe gets his info from the same sources as Panetta and Petraeus. Since as late as July 8th, our dear president promised that the evacuation from Afghanistan would be secure and orderly. 2 plus 2 equals. And he said, quote, the likelihood there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely. Unquote. According to the official narrative, as espoused by Faux News, MSDNC, and National Corporate Radio, we have the brave Afghan army defending the legitimate and democratically elected government of Afghanistan against the dreaded terrorists of the Taliban. And then, after Joe Biden's highly unlikely event came to pass, the most incredibly lame take on that highly unlikely event, unfortunately, also came from good old Uncle President, who basically said that we had spent hundreds of billions of dollars arming and training the Afghan army, and that the Afghanis cops have failed to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and fight for their own country, implying that their failure to do so was no one's fault but their own. Actually, though, the real situation was that after the Americans overran Afghanistan in 2002, the CIA armed a bunch of their old bargain basement warlords from the anti-Russian days to take over the governance. Since the Americans had already armed most of these guys back in the 80s when they fought the Russians, they had ended up being the ones who had taken charge in Afghanistan after the first time the Americans abandoned the place. And they left behind them a bunch of raping, murdering, human trafficking, extortionist drug dealers. The incredible brutality of their rule was credited by most as being the single factor most responsible for the Taliban's eventual rise to power in the 1990s. And another thing that is virtually ignored in Western media is that the Taliban is an almost pure grassroots organization, in that the Taliban is made up almost exclusively of local Afghanis. Another fact that is not only completely ignored, but actually denied in the mainstream media, is that the Taliban has a lot of popular support with the Afghani people. Not because they love the Taliban all that much, but mostly because most consider the Taliban to be far preferable to the American-backed warlords. Anyway, demonstrating their usual genius, as soon as the Americans displaced the Taliban in 2002, then in many cases, they actually put these very same warlords back in charge again. Only this time, their merry little band of paid psychopaths were armed not only with American weapons and money, but after quickly recapturing the countryside, they also very quickly revived the opium harvest that had gone from virtually zero under the Taliban to 3,600 tons within a year of the arrival of the Americans, or an extraordinary 62% of Afghanistan's entire GDP. 4 years later, the drug harvest would reach 8,200 tons, generating 53% of the country's GDP and 93% of the world's illicit heroin. Thus, the officially recognized and democratically elected government of Afghanistan was actually made up of CIA-sponsored drug dealers, or business as usual, in other words. Isn't it funny how the very same kinds of things always seem to happen everywhere that the CIA ever happens to turn up? And so, once again, anti-warlord feeling amongst the population provided yet another golden opportunity for the Taliban to once again begin reasserting itself. But this time, they abandoned their former anti-opium policy, and so these same opium fields thus began providing ample funds for the great Taliban revival as well. But drug trafficking was not the only source of income for the Taliban, though. and in fact, the Taliban often welcomed the arrival of U.S. troops into an area because that meant millions of dollars in U.S. military and USAID spending. Spending that largely went straight into the pockets of the Taliban. Ha! Obama even tried a surge, wherein he spent all kinds of money, bombs, and lives attacking the Taliban every spring. Yet here is the thing about that. His surges killed lots of people, and some of those people were actually terrorists. But Obama's surge somehow completely failed to do anything whatsoever about the central source of the Taliban's funding, i.e., the Afghani opium fields. It almost seemed as if those opium fields were protected or something. And so by 2017, the opium harvest had climbed to a new record of 9,000 tons, providing an estimated 16% of the funding for the many advances that the Taliban were making at that time, in spite of Obama's surges, or maybe because of them. So the opium was literally funding both sides of the conflict. Obama's surge also inspired the protest resignation of Matthew Ho, H-O-H, as political officer with the U.S. State Department in Afghanistan. And this is what Mr. Ho had to say on this. Quote, "When I was in Afghanistan, the biggest drug baron in southern Afghanistan was President Karzai's brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai. The biggest in eastern Afghanistan was the governor of Nangarhar province, Gul Aga Sherzai. And in the north, various warlords the U.S. worked with ran the drug trade, including the governor of Balkh province, Atta Muhammad Noor. And in Kabul, Muhammad Qasim Marshal Fahim, for whom the Afghan Military Officers Training Academy is now named. And who is the Afghan vice president was famous for using the Afghan military to transport drugs out of Afghanistan. The detailing of the criminality and gangsterism of the Afghan government is endless. Maybe best personified by the General Rashid Dostum, President Ghani's vice president, who is accused of massive war crimes. In the years following 9/11, he was forced to flee Afghanistan in 2017 after kidnapping and raping a political opponent. Unquote. So tell me, Are any of those names familiar to you? How many of those drug-dealing warlords have you heard so much as even mentioned in the mainstream press? There was a little noise when the brother of the president himself was exposed as a drug dealer, as they couldn't keep that buried. But as with the CIA's own drug trafficking operations, the fact that almost the entire Afghani political leadership is buried neck deep in drug dealing is all thoroughly documented. And all of this information is easily verifiable, if you care to verify it. Yet nary a single peep, tweet, nor squeak about any of this from the corporate media. So gee, Uncle Joe, the Afghani people don't seem inclined to rise up and defend a government that was imposed upon them by foreigners that is made up mostly of corrupt warlords, murderers, kidnappers, drug dealers, and human traffickers who are so loathsome as to make the Taliban look good in comparison. Those Afghan troops that Biden actually stated we spent so much money arming and training mostly threw down their weapons for the Taliban to find, and then they took off for home to go protect their families. As I did in that article last April, I will now ask the very same question again. After all of the unimaginable, uncounted, uncountable, unaccountable, mass death, mass displacement, mass trauma, mass cash, mass corruption, mass devastation, and multi-trillion dollars spent, not to mention all the war crimes, often featuring parents trying to find pieces of their children that were large enough to bury in the aftermath of an American drone strike. After all of those things that have all accompanied all of the American efforts in Afghanistan over the last 20 years, we're right back where we started. Except that all of those things have now happened. And all of those things cannot now unhappen. The Afghans, for the second time, joined the Vietnamese, the Kurds, the Iraqis, the Somalis, and endless others throughout history in America's junkyard of allies who are contemptuously discarded after the Americans were done using them. If you want to know what really happened in Afghanistan, I would suggest my go-to source for such information would be Alfred W. McCoy, the author of a book called The Politics of Heroin. Because Mr. McCoy has spent decades exposing politics in the context of the vast networks of CIA drug trafficking organizations, which is exactly the thing that defines the whole thing in Afghanistan. You can find Mr. McCoy's latest work at counterpunch.org. And one final comment about all this concerning this thing, where over and over again I am always getting everything right, whilst the people who actually make and implement all of the actual policies are always getting everything wrong. Well, how do you think that that happens? Do you really think that this happens because I am so smart and all of those policy people are so dumb? I don't think so. You see, it's all a con game. Almost everything that they say to you are pure lies. It's a con game, but it is an incredibly bloody and an incredibly unjust con game. The reason Afghanistan happened, and the reason it continued to happen for almost 20 years, is because a very small and very select group of people made a whole bunch of money on that deal. Period. This has nothing to do with merit, or fairness, or community, much less national security. This is nothing but bare bones of life and death. If you have the right daddy, then you're in. But if your mama was a whore, then you are less than dog a shite. And thus, you are fair game to be tossed into the fire. And now, in light of all this, Microsoft Word just scolded me for saying dog shite and suggested that I might want to consider saying dog's hit or doge shit instead. Since I did not intend to say dog's hit, nor was I referring to a doge ship, a doge ship being the domain of a chief magistrate, or a doge during the Italian Renaissance, then I doggedly stuck with dog shite, in spite of Microsoft Word's passive-aggressive form of condescending criticism concerning my linguistic choices. Anyway, no shite whatsoever now. No dog shite, nor dog's hit, nor doge ships for that matter. It's time to take a quick station break and we'll be back in just a minute. The views expressed on this program are strictly those of the show's producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station nor anyone associated with this radio station. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. Welcome back.
I know I may be young, but I've got feelings too.
Next,
and I need to do,
I wish to convey a message from my fellow chaos programmer.
And just listen. All you people look at me like I'm a little
Kim Dobson,
girl. Well, did you ever think it'd be
who is the host of Parallel University,
oh,
airing every Thursday at noon on Chaos.
I'm just trying to find out why, 'cause dancing's what I
quote, this is what corporate welfare looks like. The Olympia City Council recently voted to give 6 local millionaire speculators an 8-year, $12 million property tax break so that they will build gentrified housing in downtown Olympia. In the first quarter of 2021, 15% of U.S. homes sold were purchased by corporate investors, not families looking to achieve their American dream. While they're competing with middle-class Americans for the homes, the average American has virtually no chance of winning a home over an investment firm, which may pay 20 to 50% over the asking price in cash, sometimes scraping up entire neighborhoods at once so that they can turn them into rentals. Unquote. So even though we already live in a state with the most regressive tax structure in the entire country, and even as local and state taxes are sucking the poor and the middle class dry, the Olympia City Council is giving huge tax breaks to wealthy land developers so they can build housing the only wealthy people will be able to afford, whilst almost completely ignoring the sea of tents that seem to pop up like mushrooms everywhere, that it is possible to grow them. Especially since none of us are getting our local taxes deferred. As I was reminded when I just went to register my truck. So, Kim Dobson is doing the best reporting on this issue, and Kim regularly covers it on Parallel University, which again airs every Thursday at noon on KAOS, 89.3 FM in Olympia,
like that,
or KAOSradio.org. I believe Kim keeps archives of past shows stored somewhere, so if you want to do some exploring in this area, you can contact Kim through the Chaos website, kaosradio.org. So on to other issues now.
Like that.
Hey, people. Well, they say that when it rains, it pours. And ever since publishing my story about the penis museum in Iceland, notable penises seem to keep raining into my lap, so to speak. For instance, it turns out that some species of ducks have giant penises that in some cases exceed their body length. A species of lake duck has a penis that would be the equivalent of a man having a penis that is 12 feet long. And what makes this even weirder is that 97% of bird species do not even have penises at all. And the reason that you never see giant duck penises flying around is because they are usually coiled up inside their bodies. With Muscovy ducks, rival males will often violently force themselves onto females. They sort of live in a planet of the rapes, eh? The males will sometimes sneak up behind a female, and when he gains the proper position, his penis grows explosively and just sort of shoots into the vaginas of unsuspecting females. To gain an edge over other males, these drakes have evolved large corkscrew phalluses lined with ridges and with backward-pointing spines that allow them to deposit their sperm further into a female than their rivals. But the ladies have evolved countermeasures. Their vaginas are equally long and twisting, and they are often lined with dead-end pockets and spirals that curve in the opposite directions to thwart the rapists. Gee, you thought that your love life sucked? And meanwhile, over in New Zealand, a high-ranking cabinet minister named Carmel Sepuloni was conducting a live Zoom interview when her 12-year-old son burst into the room and began proudly displaying a carrot that he had found that looked exactly like a giant penis. When he saw that his mother was on camera, he proudly held up his prize for the millions of television viewers to admire as well. And finally, there's a movement in Wales that is advocating adding a penis to the dragon that is emblazoned upon the official Welsh flag. And if the petition receives 10,000 signatures, then that would trigger a full debate in the Welsh Assembly. And so I truly hope that they get those 10,000 signatures, because in these dire times, I think that the world could use the comic relief that would be provided by watching an official government body being forced to discuss the subject of penises on dragons. All right, moving right along now. Next on the agenda, we wish to comment upon the collective wisdom of our National Congress. On September 15, 2001, Congress voted 420-1.
Okay, fellas, let's play the polka. Just counting your blessings wherever you are. Okay, one, two.
To give President George W. Bush the authorization to invade Afghanistan, with that lone no vote being cast by newly minted Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California. And not only that, but in casting her vote, Ms. Waters gave a truly incredible speech that predicted nearly everything that was about to happen. Yes, hindsight provides 20/20 vision, but 420-1 vision? Doesn't that qualify as, like, being legally blind? You know, I would maintain that Julian Assange has done more to teach us how the elites abuse their power than any other single human in history.
There were three men came out of the West.
He has also been completely nonpartisan.
Their fortunes for to try. And these three men made a solemn vow.
When he exposed George W. Bush's many war crimes,
corn must die.
The right was screaming for his head.
They've plowed, they've sown.
Whilst the left rose to their feet and cheered. Then, when he exposed Hillary Clinton as an utterly corrupt gangster,
and these three men made a solemn vow.
It was the other way around.
Barleycorn was dead.
With Mrs. Clinton herself accusing Julian Assange of being a Russian agent. Even though Julian Assange also exposed Vladimir Putin as an utterly corrupt gangster at around that very same time. And even though Julian Assange was nothing but a journalist who was simply reporting upon facts,
they've let him lie for a very long time.
And facts that have been freely given to him.
Rains from heaven.
By others.
And little Sir John sprung up his head.
In spite of that, he's being treated
so amazed them all
as a hostile enemy agent.
They've let him stand to mid-service day till he looked both pale and wrong.
Julian Assange is now being prosecuted. Basically,
and little Sir John's grown a long, long beard
for being so good at journalism.
And so become a man.
The Americans are prosecuting him, even though he isn't an American, even though he has never lived in nor published in America. What that means is the Americans are claiming the power to prosecute any journalist anywhere in the world if that journalist says anything that the American government doesn't like.
They've hired men with the side so sharp to cut him off at the knee.
As a result of these charges,
they've rolled him and tied him by the way.
Julian Assange was kept under the equivalent of house arrest for 6 years.
They've hired men with the sharpest forks who pricked him to the heart.
And he now has spent the last 2 years being tortured via solitary confinement.
And he has served him.
He is reportedly displaying all of the typical symptoms of PTSD. It appears as if they may have succeeded in breaking Mr. Assange. But his information is still out there. And some of his biggest persecutors won Pulitzer Prizes with that information.
They wheeled him around and around a field.
This was all planned.
Till they came onto a bomb.
According to journalist John Pilger,
and they made a solemn oath.
Quote,
on poor John Barleycorn.
In 2008, a top secret U.S. State Department report described in detail how the United States would combat this new moral threat.
And the Miller, he has served him worse than that.
It would be a secret personal smear campaign that would be mounted against Julian Assange. That would lead to, quote, exposure and criminal prosecution. Yes, people, their aim was to silence and criminalize both WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange. Page after page of the 2008 State Department report revealed the most powerful country in the world preparing to go to war against a single person. In doing so, was fully aware that the collateral damage would include such things as freedom of speech, thought, and democracy itself. If I were president, I would give Julian Assange the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
And little Sir John and the nut brown bowl.
That is the highest reward it is possible to bestow upon a civilian.
The huntsman, he caught the fox.
Since Joe Biden is not only a lifelong persecutor of whistleblowers, but indeed he has been one of the lead persecutors of whistleblowers for decades now. So I don't expect that to happen. It should happen, though. In fact, I would argue that no one else has done as much to deserve that award, and I would argue that few, if any, has paid such a high price for doing so than anyone else who has ever actually won that award. It's time to get to work now. But first, a little music to ease you into the transition. And this week, we're going to take you back to the 1980s Seattle college scene and play some Uncle Banzai. Enjoy.
Part two in the Wild Woman leitmotif is a song about an office worker named Susie.
some clothes. To wear a nose or dance. She's got a little car that uses diesel gas. It's got the foreign name. She thinks it gives her class. She doesn't cook too well. She doesn't speak too good. She knows of all the men within her neighborhood. She gives them all the eye and chooses one or two to buy her little things and have a rendezvous. She has a rendezvous. She tries to look her best.
She tries so hard to smile.
She wants them all to see.
She's got a touch of style.
She wears a slitted dress,
but just a little fun.
And acts so nonchalant
as she goes walking by.
She thinks the men are cute.
She likes to wheel them in.
It's just to play it cool.
With just a touch of sin, she makes them draw up strong
to see who'll take her out.
She likes a doggy dog.
And they begin to shout,
Susie, won't you come out tonight?
So
Susie, won't you go for a ride?
So
Susie, I got tickets for the best show in town. Won't you come along and sit by my side? Susie, won't you go to the game? Susie, won't you come to the dance? Susie, don't you think that I can come inside? Susie, won't you give me a chance?
Okay, maybe. She's learned to set her goals.
She wants an even tan.
She doesn't mind her work.
She does the best she can.
She gives the men a smile.
They think she fools around.
They want to buy her drinks.
She wants to settle down.
She likes to play that fee.
She thinks it's a fair game.
She knows how much he's worth
before she knows his name.
She doesn't want it by.
She thinks he knows his
life. She thinks the fire are nice.
The way they always fight.
Susie, won't you come out tonight? Susie, won't you come for a ride? Susie, I got tickets for the best show in town. Won't you come along and sit by my side? Susie, won't you go to the game? Susie, won't you come to the dance? Susie, don't you think that I could come inside? Oh, Susie, won't you give me a chance?
She thinks she needs that walk.
She wants to dress as tight. She wish she had the nerve
to be alone at night.
She's got her mind made up.
She's found the only way.
She hates the pressure, but she likes to hear them say,
Susie, won't you come out tonight? Susie, won't you go for a ride? Susie, I could take us for the best show in town. Won't you come along and sit by my side? Susie, won't you go to the game? Susie, won't you come to the dance? Susie, don't you think that I could come inside? Susie, won't you give me a chance?
This song is about cheerleaders. I grew up in a little town in Indiana, not too far from here, about 30 miles, and I was a cheerleader in seventh grade. And then in eighth grade, I didn't make it. And I was very sad about it. And I had to get over it. So my way of getting over it was to keep those cheers alive in my memory. And so one of my favorite cheers is contained in this next song. This song is about the kind of cheerleaders we must have been back then. It's called Cheerleaders on Drugs.
How do they jump so high?
How do they dip in mid?
And spread their legs so wide?
And wear the skirts that they wear?
How do they mount each one?
To make the pyramids?
Is it the drugs they're on?
Is mental invalids?
They wear their dark sunglasses.
They play the games at night.
The players make their passes.
They drop their pom-poms just to run.
The mascot sneaks inside.
He's probably overspread.
The game's not over yet. It's time to go to bed. It seems like they must be on drugs or just stupid. They're buoyant and fussy and just plain dumb. It seems like they're brainwashed or on anesthesia. Their brain suffers weight loss, cause how else could they cheer like go? Go, go, you engines, chagawa, chagawa. Go, you engines, go, go, you engines, chagawa. Engines got the power. Go, G-O, go. It stunts their mental growth.
It makes it hard to find
a future livelihood
for others of their kind.
The marching band, it seems,
the boyers in the stands,
the refs and both the teams are all the raving fans.
Cheerleaders on drugs. Cheerleaders on drugs. Cheerleaders on drugs. It seems like they must be on drugs to stupid. They're more than bossy and just plain dumb. The drug interaction could just be some teamwork. Their voices and factions make them sound like go, you engines, go, go, you engines.
Here's something they used to make us do back then.
Go, you engines, go, go, you engines.
Then we thought of this one on our own. Give me an I, give me an N,
N,
give me a J,
J, U, N, S.
Go, you Indians, go,
cheerleaders on drugs.
Cheerleaders.
Boys want sex in the morning, sex in the morning, when I'm not my best.
Want sex in the morning,
petting and pawing, tearing at my breast.
Want someone who's winsome,
someone to pin, someone to undertake.
Want someone to fall on, someone to crawl on, someone half awake.
Want sex in the morning, sex in the morning, covers at my knees.
Want rotten conditions, passive positions,
I am a trapeze.
Want someone who's sleepy, someone who's keeping nothing in too deep.
Want somebody first hand,
someone to burst and then go back to sleep. There is nothing I like better than a jostle now and then, with the hands under the sweater and the back that starts to bend. But before my eyes are open, I don't want to have to hide from a simpleton still poking with a thimble full of pride. Boys want sex in the morning, sex in the morning, soiling the sheets.
Boys want sex while I'm yawning, suddenly spawning when I'm half asleep.
Boys want someone unconscious,
somebody not just waiting for a thrill.
Boys want sex with surprises, sex with sunrises,
someone on the pill. There is nothing like a lover who can satisfy your needs, and the joy when you discover just how often he succeeds. But before my eyes can focus, I don't need him to surprise by descending like some locust on a field of sleeping thighs. Boys want sex in the morning, sex in the morning, when I'm still not fresh.
Want something that strikes them,
someone who likes them, fondling their flesh.
Want someone to take and someone to break and comment on their size.
Want someone to prod and
someone who'll nod and then just close her eyes.
Boys want sex in the morning. Before that, we had Cheerleaders on Drugs. Started that set off with a tune called Susie. All of those from a band called Uncle Banzai. Please remember that the views expressed on the Thunderbolt do not necessarily reflect the views of any of the stations that air the Thunderbolt. And speaking of those stations, you might want to contribute to them so they can stay on the air. All of the stations that air the Thunderbolt are listener-supported. So that's it for this week. Hope to see you next week. And in the meanwhile...
Thank you very much.